As the father and son approached the office on the third floor of the museum, Sekhmet snapped open the door and saluted. The Baron waved in passing, and Leonard returned the salute properly. The office was tremendously huge, covering half of a floor. To the east was a working stone fireplace, surrounded by a sunken living room of plush couches. A wooden desk stood in the center of the room, and behind it on the wall was a map of the ville and surrounding lands. The floor was smooth fieldstone, dotted with a dozen matching white rugs. To the west was a bookcase made of mirrors and glass shelves, and on display was the first ear of corn grown in the first greenhouse. Fancy auto-fire blasters, all of which worked and were loaded, geodes because they were pretty, hundreds of bottles of liquor and pre-dark wine, a few specially marked bottles, expertly poisoned, and a small teakwood box nearly full of human ears, taken from every man who had ever challenged Strickland to a duel. Assassins simply went into the machine, and the Baron drank a cup of their blood in order to steal their souls and make himself stronger. As the door closed behind them, the elder Strickland took the chair behind the massive cherrywood desk and put his boots on the mirror's smooth surface.
Report.
Leonard placed his armload of papers on an empty chair.
Three people came in yesterday, but they were chased by only six wolves.
Strickland cracked his knuckles, and his red hair stirred with impatience.
Bastard birds, or whatever the muties are, have been breeding again. Every time we find their nest and burn it out, they're back again in a couple of months.
We may never find the main nest.
Obviously. If it weren't for my searchlights, the things would have destroyed Alphaville months ago. Are the lights in good working order?
Yes, Father. Perfect shape. I check them myself every day.
The redhead smiled benignly.
Good lad.
We could send in more men to search the ruins.
Gunther shook his head.
And risk one of them finding the old Baron's secret weapons cache and starting a war over the ville? I think not.
Why did the old Baron hide his weapons outside the ville?
You've never asked me that question before.
It never seemed important before. It is my duty to know such things.
The Baron placed his boots on the floor with a thump and beamed proudly.
At last, you're taking an interest in ruling our land. Excellent. Baron Harvin did that, so in case of a rebellion, he could regroup Sekhmet outside the ville and blast their way back in to seize control.
But none of the troops stayed loyal.
A lesson to remember, future Baron. Always stay on the good side of the troops. That is why a gaudy house was the first thing I built, even before the greenhouses. The Sekhmet go there for free, which makes them happy. None of the farmers' daughters or wives is attacked, which makes them happy, which increases the production of food, which makes everyone happy. These people would willingly march into a rat pit for me.
And they would do that someday, too, Gunther added privately. Every last one of the stinking Norm bastards, once he had a real son to replace him as Baron. That was, if he ever managed to sire a true heir, and wasn't saddled with this obedient milksop for the rest of his life. But despite his efforts so far to locate red-haired females with the gift, he knew that there was in all likelihood the possibility that he would never find any. Therefore, he had been using his talents to manipulate the usually mild-mannered teen into becoming more of the type of leader Strickland wanted him to be, completely without Leonard's knowledge.
Father? Something wrong?
The middle-aged man smiled gently.
Nothing, my son. Nothing.
Rising from his chair, the Baron started to pace the room.
The searchlights, which keep away the muties, also attract more people. Both are good things. However, a larger population means more noise, and more activity, which attracts the muties. It's a vicious circle. Our only defense weakens us and makes us more of a juicy target. For 10 months we've been walking the razor's edge. I took the veil from the monster who controlled it before. There are no more random beheadings, no more rape or cannibalism. We have greenhouses and grow enough food for an army. We have trials and gaudy houses. The population has tripled since I took over. Tripled!
Gunther stopped at the mirrored wall and toyed with the teakwood box for a moment before replacing it on the shelf.
We have over 1,000 people here, son. That's bigger than most pre-dark cities. Clean food, and we burn wood to make charcoal to purify the mountain water. Nobody has gotten ill from the river for months. But we must have those blasters to kill the bats. If the light should ever fail during an attack, our people would be slaughtered.
We could use alcohol bombs to set fire to the whole city.
not if we want the weapons. And that has always been the Twix. And we must soon decide, the bats or the blasters. It seems we can't have both.
Strickland paused, knowing his next request wouldn't please his adopted son. But it was time for him to learn that running a bill was often bloody work.
Go get the old man.
Leonard stayed in his chair, breathing heavily, then stood and saluted.
I understand. Yes, sir.
Going to the door, Leonard stuck his head outside and motioned to two burly Sekmen. Minutes later, they dragged a scrawny man into the room. They efficiently tied the near corpse to a stout wooden chair, and upon a signal from Leonard, went back outside. Drawing a revolver, Gunther extracted every bullet but one. Spinning the cylinder, he aimed and pulled the trigger. Former Baron Harbin jumped involuntarily at the click. The Baron spun it again.
My patience is gone, old man. Tell me where the weapons are.
Never!
Then where are the bats hidden? Or how can we control them? Colored flags? Special clothes? Some odor, hand signals? Whistles?
For a brief instant, Gunther thought the former Baron registered surprise, but then realized it was just a tick brought on by the starvation and torture. Strickland dry-fired the revolver again and again.
Tell me!
Harbin smiled toothlessly.
Never tell you. Took my vill, but you can't keep it. Keep it. That's a joke.
Secretly hating to do it, Leonard lashed out and slapped the bound man. Teeth and spittle sprang across the room.
Obey my father or die!
Bleeding freely, the former Baron sat there with his head tilted. Then, ever so slowly, he turned to stare at the hated usurper, the fire of reason burning bright in his face.
You have trained the little bastard well, thief. He's a most fitting son for a traitor, and while you manage to steal the vill, you'll never keep it.
Then madness welled within the man. After so many months, he simply couldn't hold the secret in any longer.
Only Harold and I know how to control the Guardians, and Harold's dead, which leaves me. Eventually, the muties will get past whatever you're using to stop them, and then it's your day in the barrel. You lose. Can't keep it.
Father and son stared in astonishment at each other, and then both slowly smiled.
Excellent. I knew keeping that gimp around would pay off.
Thank you so much for helping us.
Leonard felt a weird, wonderful rush of power from the terror of the old man, not knowing exactly where it came from. Harbin went deathly pale.
No, impossible! You told me months ago that Harold was dead, showed me his corpse!
Gunther corrected him with a smirk.
A corpse. An invader who resembled your friend, nothing more. Harold lives.
Gunther came closer to the shivering ex-baron.
And now that I know he has the secret, I have no need of you.
Cracking the cylinder of the blaster, the Baron loaded every hole. Sweat began to run off the man.
No! Wait! I can tell you where the weapon caches are and how to get past the traps!
Not interested.
Closing the blaster with a snap of the wrist, Gunther spun the cylinder for no reason, placed the muzzle to the old man's chest, and shot him dead. Feeling ill, Leonard stared at the corpse. He had been an enemy of the Ville, and deserved to die. It was a job to be done, and he did what he had to. Yet there was an odd, almost sexual energy to the act of murder. This contradiction confused him greatly.
Send out 20 Sekmen, and tell them not to come back until they have Harold in custody, alive and unharmed. Mind you, he's useless chilled.
The sergeant may be outside the walls. We've had trouble finding him before.
Then send 50 men with bolt-action rifles from my private armory and 10 live rounds.
10?
We can afford it. Besides, if he is out among the muties, our troops will have to defend themselves. And every dead mutie is a point in our favor. But first, and most importantly, find Harold.
Harold moved through the dank pipeway with the surety of a bullet in a barrel. Feeder pipes lined the main conduit, with rusty water dripping constantly from the corroded openings. His footing was treacherous, as the curved walls were slimy beneath his hands. But this was the way back home, and every step made his heart feel lighter. He had something better than the blasters, or even the war wag,
He had a doctor's bag.
That saved lives. Lots better than killing. The voices in his head agreed wholeheartedly and complimented him constantly, sometimes painfully loud. He had really tried to take the big blaster off the top of the war wag, but he couldn't figure out how to free the ammo belt. After dragging it behind him for a block, Harold had tossed it away. Besides, the long dangling belt was too noisy. Never sneak in here with that. Scampering noises sounded from the darkness ahead of him, and Harold quickly reached inside his shirt and blew on the silent whistle. He felt a stab inside his ears, as always, and the scampering sounds quickly departed. The man had no idea how the broken whistle could chase away rats. The voices suggested they had a better range of hearing than humans, but his chest started to pound as he struggled to understand the odd words, and the voices soon ceased, replaced by soothing silence. After a while, the drain branched into a full six-way intersection, and Harold carefully jumped across the gap into the next tunnel. Staying to the left, he counted aloud on fingers and toes until reaching his right pinky toe and climbed a ladder set into the concrete wall. Pushing aside the iron grating, he eased out of the storm drain and glanced around to make sure nobody could see him. Over by the big tunnel that went under the dead river, twin searchlights swept the sky. The air was foggy with the reflection of the powerful beams. Climbing out, the hunchback eased the grating quietly back into position. Then, staying close to the wall of cars, he kept low until finding the faded orange bumper sticker. There were no others like it anywhere on the wall. One had been similar, and in a fit of brilliance, he had removed the bumper so as not to become confused between the two. But then, Harold spent days trying to figure out if he'd removed the correct sticker. Life was so confusing sometimes, and the voices in his head didn't always help, even though they said different. Grabbing the handle of the Pontiac, he eased the back door open, lifting it slightly so the metal wouldn't squeal. Stepping inside, he carefully locked it behind him and started the labyrinthine return to the ville on the other side. From this point onward, Harold knew he was safe. Nobody could follow him through the wall, not even the rats. The cloudy yellow sky was just beginning to lighten in color, slashes of fiery orange streaking across the murky gray atmosphere as dawn struggled into existence. The front door to the government building opened on freshly oiled hinges, and Ryan stepped onto the broken sidewalk.
Good enough.
The rest of the companions joined him outside. They had spent the night in hurried preparation, blocking the exposed stairwell solid with office furniture, doing the same to the elevator shaft, and nailing all of the office doors shut, and driving extra nails through the middle of the wooden panels so that anybody trying to crash through would be badly bloodied. Forming a semicircle across the lobby was a 6-foot-tall barricade of metal file cabinets stuffed with books and backed with the couches. It made a pretty good firewall and helped muffle any lights or noises. There was still a lot of work to be done, but it was a good start. Purely precautionary, but experience taught hard lessons over the years. Better safe than dead, as the trader always used to say. Unfortunately, Dean was no better by morning, if anything a bit worse, and the necessity of reclaiming the med kit had been escalated to a priority. Walking over to the garage, Jack knelt on the sandy ground, running his fingers over the faint indentations across the ground. A breeze ruffled his snowy hair as he stood and walked into the street.
One man, big, walks funny, maybe wounded. Came from down block.
He came from the ville. Can you track the Hummer?
Jack glanced over his shoulder, his ruby-red eyes deadly serious.
Track to Monsoon for Dean.
Who's to stay?
Ryan slid the stire off his shoulder and checked the clip.
JB and Doc.
Ramming the cylinder back into the blaster, he slapped the bolt.
JB, think you can fix that skylight before we get back with the wag?
No problem. Found some replacement glass for the windows and such in the basement. Won't take me more than an hour.
Good. Doc, take the roof as lookout. Stay sharp, but don't fire at anything, even another of those damn muties.
Until young Master Dean is mobile, we shall be the most devout of cowards.
JB, when the roof is done, spell Mildred. Make her get some sleep. She's got to be rested and alert.
Just in case. I understand. No problem. Get the med kit and chill the bastard who stole it from under our noses.
That's my plan.
Thunder rumbled softly in the mottled heavens.
Wind is increasing, and the damn tractor half gone already.
Gotta go now.
Right, Jack. JB, Doc, if we have any live company when we return, we'll use the standard ABC codes.
Gotcha.
JB clearly remembered when they first invented the alphabet code. If one of their group showed up with strangers, how could the rest know if the newcomers were okay or armed aggressors? The solution was as simple as the problem was basic. If the companions identified themselves or the stranger with any name starting with the letter A, Alfred, Alexander, anything like that, it meant there was no danger. All clear. If they used a B name, it meant bad news. They were being forced to comply with the folks they were with. And if they used a C name, it meant the whole thing was crap, kill everybody, including the companion.
Godspeed, sir. My prayers go with you.
I don't think your God would approve of my plans for today.
Ryan turned to the street. Down the block, Christie stood attentively on the corner, while Jack was inspecting the crumpled ruin of a mailbox.
Freshly sideswiped.
The albino then studied the ground and faced north.
Hummer went this way.
Spreading out so they wouldn't present a group target to any snipers, the companions followed the main street until Ryan found a clear set of tracks in some smooth stretch of sand.
East.
Cutting through a brick-lined alleyway, they disturbed a nest of green-skinned lizards that turned as pale as sand and scattered at their intrusion. Climbing over a low mound of rubble from a fallen cinder-block wall, they proceeded across a bare parking lot, the ancient black macadam partially hidden under the wind-blown sand and tufts of dead weeds sprouting from the many cracks in the black surface. The lot was edged with a short concrete wall, the kiosk smashed under a fallen telephone pole. No tracking skills were needed to spot the fresh tire tracks in the churned masonry.
Did he know the Hummer was tough enough to take the wall? Or was he driving with the lights off?
Christie watched the rooftops for any suspicious movements.
Headlight switch is clearly marked on the dashboard. Especially at night, they glow. Oh, no, wait. I busted one of them yesterday.
Even so, scared we following?
Jack pointed.
Ammo box!
Ryan walked over and picked up the green metal container. It was from the redoubt.
Must have lost it when he took the wall.
Rolled down street. Couldn't do it driving all over place.
That was an unusually long speech for the normally monosyllabic Jack.
Damaged the box?
Ryan turned it over in his hands.
Dents and scrapes, but it wasn't hit by the Hummer, if that's what you mean. Army ammo boxes are tough, but the 5-ton wag would flatten this like a soup can.
Resting a hand on her canteen to stop it from bouncing as she walked, Christie started toward the intersection.
Then he went this way.
For the next 10 blocks, they proceeded quickly, following a set of disappearing tire tracks to a scraped wall, and through the center of a department store, the huge glass window on one side shoved in, and the other side busted out. Ryan treaded carefully over the glass shards.
Driving like a lunatic. Must have known he was safe by now. We only had the one wag.
Afraid somebody else might see him? Maybe he's a solo who just wandered by, or a rogue living in the ruins, avoiding the Sekhmen of the Ville.
Jack didn't agree.
Excited. First time stealing. Kid, maybe.
Who got past a trap from J.B.?
Jack shrugged in reply. Too many questions and not enough info. Ryan hated mysteries. Give him a good stand-up fight any day. Checking a side street, the Deathlands warrior saw that the soft surface was smooth and untouched.
Nothing this way. Christie?
The redhead stepped through the ruins of a wooden fence.
Over here. Our thief was driving like he was being chased.
Muties?
Ryan kept a watch on a dark hole in a broken wall.
Or the wolves. Maybe he was driving like this so the wolves could follow him to the muties, give them something to feed on, and leave him alone.
Following the tire tracks through the sand, Ryan took point, and, rounding a corner, found himself before a block-long three-story building. It was a school of some kind, with a tilted flagpole standing in the front, and an empty parking lot to the east side. The front and side of the structure was marked with bullet holes, the ground churned from explosives, but smoothed again by the wind. The windows were gone, blackened holes with the sky visible where a roof should have been. Taking refuge around the corner, they used the mirror in turns to study the building. The tire tracks of the Hummer led straight to the side of the building, where a gaping doorway stood more than large enough to drive the military wag through.
Garage?
Looks like.
Looks like a public school, definitely not private. Those are always surrounded by high walls to keep out the riffraff.
Must have been a hell of a fight.
Ryan imagined the battle in his mind.
Blasters, Molotov cocktails, and some C4 bombs. Went hand to hand over there.
Are those arrows in that fence?
Check. Must have used them when they ran out of ammo.
Happened 5-6 months ago, depending on rain.
Think the defenders were fighting the muties?
Baring his teeth, Ryan exhaled and tried not to think of the passing of time.
Well, I sure as hell hope there's nothing else in this hellhole that can attack a third-story window.
Don't seem to be any Sekhmen on patrol. Area looks empty.
No snipers or lookouts.
Jack studied the rooftops while unfolding the foil on one of his precious last sticks of army chewing gum. He folded it in two and started to chew with his mouth closed. Breakfast had been cold wolf, and his tongue tasted as if something had died there.
Let's take no chances.
The hairs on the back of Ryan's neck stirred. He slicked them down with a palm. Something was wrong here. He could feel it. He just didn't know what, exactly.
Tracks leading to a burned-out school, with nobody around. Smells bad to me. Could be a trap, and we know these folks are tricky. We'll do a tight perimeter sweep, single file, 2-yard spread. If there's no activity, we go inside.
Christy took her weapon in a double-hand grip.
If this is a trap, then they'll want us alive, which gives us a tremendous edge in chilling them, because we're only interested in the med kit. Don't give a rat's ass about them.
Jack held up a restraining hand.
Wait for wind. Cover sound of boots. Wait. Now.
Moving fast through the ruins outside the parking lot, the trio kept low. A lizard eating a tarantula darted away at their passage, but nothing else responded to their presence. No barking dogs, no gunshots, no cries of alarm. Reaching a ditch opposite the garage, they slid in and splashed quietly through the brackish runoff water, which reeked of sulfur. Using the mirror first, then chancing a direct look, they could see the Hummer parked amid the cold ashes and burned timbers of the building. The WAG was a lot more battered than when they had last seen it. The sides were scraped, the radio antenna was gone, and the spare tire was flat and hanging loose on the rim bolted to the chassis. Ryan pointed left and right. The others spread out and approached the garage from converging directions. At the doorway, they took positions, listening for sounds, then charged in with blasters at the ready. Jack took the grease pit, Christy the office, Ryan the tool room. The garage was completely deserted. Chewing steadily, Jack went under the chassis of the WAG, while Christy stood guard and Ryan circled the vehicle, looking for tripwires. In the cargo area, he found the long blasters from the pawn shop, but the med kit and the big M60 were nowhere in sight, which was expected. Those items were the most valuable. In a few moments, Jack came back out.
Clean. You?
Same here. The thief just took what he could carry and left, probably planning on coming back to get the rest. We can't wait for that to happen. Could be days before he returns.
How did he start it? Oh, took the radio fuse and inserted it into the ignition. That was dumb.
Yeah, might have shorted out the engine and blown the whole electrical system. It's what you do in an emergency situation.
Maybe it was for him.
Sliding in the proper fuse, Ryan hit the ignition and checked the gauges on the dashboard.
At least we know why he abandoned it here. She's out of gas.
Christy gratefully slid off her backpack, the contents sloshing as it hit the ground.
We got that covered. Doc was smart enough to hide the extra fuel in the lab.
She refueled the WAG as the others kept guard, watching the shop and the steel girders above them for a suspicious movement. Some yellow papers blew among the wreckage, and then lifted away on a breeze into the sky. The redhead capped the container and placed it in the rear with the rifles.
Done.
Drive?
We're too close to the river. May as well leave the WAG here, out of sight of the Sekhmen on the wall. Christy, take all of the fuses, and let's do a perimeter sweep for footprints.
Sure enough, only a few yards away they located tracks marked with black soot from the burned-out school. Following the footprints across a football field and through a dry creek bed, they reached the edge of the river. The clouds were a vile green overhead, slashed with fiery orange. If a storm was coming, it was going to be hell on earth, and that made them move faster. Reaching the concrete dockyards, they noted that the sluggish river from yesterday was now churning madly, whitecaps crashing on the embankments as the water rushed into the east. Jack scrutinized the stony concrete.
Scuffle. No, slipped. Check water.
Christy leaned over the edge.
No sign of a... Wait, there's the M60! Oh, crap, the barrel's bent. Must have hit something on the way down.
Useless.
Jack scanned the river.
No sign, kid. Must have kept.
Feeling the pressure on him, Ryan glanced east and west along the river, both directions equally barren of tracks. Every second made the thief farther away, and increased the risk for Dean. Fast decisions and fast action were called for, and if he had to gamble, so be it. This close to the Ville, the logical place to look was the tunnel. Maybe he was a refugee, or a guard. The medkit could be only 100 yards away in the hands of the Sekhmen, pawing through the instruments, wondering what they were.
Let's go.
Following the embankment, they reached the concrete apron that capped the top of the tunnel they had observed the previous day. Long ago, a fence of some kind had skirted the apron to keep the curious from going over the side. But nowadays, there were only a few gutted metal posts to show where the safety barrier had once stood. Crawling on hands and knees to reduce their exposure, the companions started to creep across the apron when Christie paused and snapped her fingers for attention. She jerked her head to the left, and they followed her toward a low rise in the concrete. An iron grill covered a hole in the concrete. On the other side was a pipe with a ladder going down and out of sight. But more importantly, off to the side, a smudged footprint was cut in two by the grating. Ryan touched it with a fingertip, and the ash came off easily. Looking it over closely, he couldn't see an exterior locking mechanism or even hinges. Sliding the sling of his rifle over his shoulder, Ryan braced himself and tried to lift the grating, but it refused to budge. Christie and Jack joined him at the task, and the trio put their backs into it. But the grill didn't move an inch. The companions backed off a few yards.
That's where he went. But without explosives, we're not getting in. Either it weighs a ton, or else there's some trick to holding it in place. Magnetic seal, maybe. Or hydraulics.
6 inches of thick metal. I'm not sure even a Gren would do the trick. Plas X, sure, but JB has all of that.
Ryan frowned.
Didn't think we'd need any on a hunt.
Window no good.
Jack jerked a thumb.
Use front door.
After a minute, Ryan nodded his agreement. There didn't seem to be any other way into the tunnel without alerting the whole Ville to their presence. The thief had effectively blocked any possible pursuit from this direction. Going to their bellies, the companions crawled forward over the pre-dark concrete, the rough material scratching at their clothes and scraping exposed skin. They stopped at the edge when voices could be heard, men complaining about eating vegetables, and some bitch named Patrika. Gently putting down his rifle, Ryan unearthed the plastic mirror and looked around, then withdrew.
Same as yesterday. 2 guards armed with muzzle-loading long blasters, one with a hand blaster on his belt. Searchlights on either side beyond a sandbag wall. No sign of the medkit.
Christie looked at the low buildings nearby and discounted them. The thief couldn't live that close to the Ville and stay hidden for very long. And he headed straight here, so the medkit was in the Ville somewhere. Probably in the hands of the Baron by now, or whoever ruled the place. They knew nothing of what was on the other side of the wall.
If they don't have it, then where did the thief go?
Let's ask.
Jack drew a grin from a pocket, a pre-dark pineapple from World War II. The color coding showed it was a concussion grenade, used for distractions and evasions. Useless for battle, as the kill range was less than a yard, but it was perfect for taking prisoners. He wiggled the pin free.
Might lose one, maybe two, but only need one.
Considering the matter, Ryan reluctantly vetoed the idea.
Still too damn noisy. If there are more guards inside the tunnel, we'll have a major fight, with reinforcements coming from the Ville. We've got to be quiet.
Christie drew a sleek stiletto from her boot.
I say we jump them. Toss a blaster far down the road, and when they start forward to investigate, we take them from behind. Knife in the lungs and nobody makes a sound.
Can't breathe. Can't scream.
Very well. I hate being quiet anyway.
Ryan drew his panga, the curved blade streaked with dried blood from the previous night's interrupted dinner. The sight shocked the man, as he had never gone so long before without cleaning the weapon. He had to take his mind off Dean and concentrate on killing the Sekhmen. Then, a familiar rumble sounded from the ruins, and a horn beeped in warning.
Shit! Convoy!
The distant rumble of engines became louder, until around the corner lumbered an old World War II Jeep jammed full of men. Behind it was a flatbed truck piled with mattresses, and lastly, a battered U.S. mail truck, the driver wearing a gas mask.
Exhaust pipe leak?
Scowling, Ryan said nothing, and Jack continued to unwrap the electrical tape from the handle of the Gren. The convoy of Predark vehicles pulled to a ragged stop in front of the tunnel, and the drivers got out. The tunnel guards walked over to greet the newcomers, and soon the two groups were smoking pipes and swapping canteens. From the reactions, some of the containers didn't contain water. The desert breezes carried away most of the conversation, with only scraps audible to the companions. His ruby eyes going wide, Jack curled a lip in disgust. Christie turned slightly pale, and Ryan felt sick to his stomach. The local baron was using people as fertilizer in greenhouses? Part of him acknowledged the intelligence of the notion, turning liabilities into assets, but the whole thing was a bit too close to cannibalism for him. Ryan motioned for a retreat, and the companions crawled back to the river some 50 yards away, where they could converse in private.
Gaia, eating their own dead.
With a curt hand motion, Ryan interrupted.
Doesn't matter. This is even better than questioning the guards. This is our way in and out of the Ville. Everybody agrees the thief must have sold the kit to the Baron, right?
Brisk nods answered the question.
Okay, then. So do we. Here's the plan.
Hey, Larry, you gotta see this.
Puffing on his corncob pipe, Larry started over as Trevor, a sec man of dubious intelligence, leaned his long blaster against a truck, the hot engine under the battered hood ticking loudly as it cooled, and began to unfold a glossy sheet of paper.
What you got, Trevor?
Found this on the wall of a brake shop. Not bad, huh?
A smile growing wide, Larry gazed at the naked woman, dressed in lace and bound in leather.
God damn, that's hot.
Darla Crane. Gotta love them redheads.
A third man leaned against the tiled wall and tapped his pipe out in a palm.
Yeah, blondes do it for me. As long as they don't carry knives. Ah, what the hell. Pass her over, boys. Give me a gander, too.
Larry ambled closer with the mag.
Just don't drool all over it, Mac.
And give it back when you're done.
Just then, the sound of a roaring engine broke the silence of the Predark ruins.
Another one of ours coming in?
Dropping the poster, Mac grabbed his blaster and cocked the hammer. Only the wolf pack got bolt-action blasters, and nobody had auto-fires anymore. But these muzzle-loaders still killed at 100 paces, even if they did make enough smoke to blind a man.
I said, is it ours, Mac?
As a member of the wolf pack, Mac got special considerations from the Baron.
Hell no. We're lucky to have these three rolling at the same time. Them rust buckets are always breaking down.
The noise drastically increased, and a huge vehicle erupted around the corner, sand and dust spraying off the tires as it spun in a circle in the intersection. The driver seemed to be lost, confused, or insane.
This way!
Mac buttoned his police uniform while waving a hand.
Run for the tunnel! We'll hold off the wolves!
Obediently, the wag started forward, and they caught sight of the driver, an albino with snow-white hair and eyes like rubies.
Muty!
The mysterious driver spun the vehicle in a figure-eight pattern, kicking up a tremendous dust cloud. The segmen covered their faces with neckerchiefs as the desert wind blew the choking cloud over the tunnel opening. Then the driver slammed on the brakes, the nose of the wag dipping toward the ground and the wheels squealing in protest. As it bounced to a halt, the albino drew his mammoth blaster, the long barrel gleaming in the dim daylight. The driver fired twice, the sounds echoing down the tunnel. Oddly, the slugs hit the tunnel wall, cracking the tiles, but nothing more. The pale stranger stomped on the accelerator, the big wag spinning its tires in the sand, raising an even bigger cloud than before as it sped away, zigzagging wildly back and forth down the road. Leveling his museum piece rifle, Trevor eased back the iron hammer, checked the flint, and pulled the trigger, all in one smooth motion. Flame and smoke thundered from the pitted muzzle of the 2-yard-long blaster. In spite of the moving target, the mini-ball scored a direct hit on the military wag, but only ricocheted off the armored side. Then the wag took a corner and was gone.
You muck-eating idiot! He wasn't going to stop with you shooting at him!
He was a muty! Whiter than milk! Probably a sticky from the waist down, or something even worse!
Don't care if he was part blood rat! Stop the wag and then kill the driver, fool! How many times have I told you that?
Larry ran toward the two arguing sec men, brushing the dust out of his bushy beard.
Son of a bitch! Stop yelling at each other and let's go get that bastard!
No need to chase him. He can hide from the wolves during the day. But when night falls and the bats start hunting, he'll come crawling back. Tomorrow his ass is ours.
And then we'll make him pay.
Yeah. They don't all have to be alive. Baron needs corpses, too.
Beating the dust off his caked clothes, Trevor started to agree with the lead sec man when he heard a metallic creak. Turning fast, revolver steady at his hip, the sec man blinked a few moments to clear his sight. Nothing seemed unusual or misplaced. Then he could have sworn that his mail truck moved slightly. He walked over and yanked open the doors. Inside were corpses of some drug dealers piled haphazardly on the floorboards of the vehicle, bones and organs exposed, loose limbs and hands lying in the corners horribly, where the winged muties had clawed their bodies to pieces. Sprawled on top was an intact male corpse without an eye, and a redhead female dressed in military coveralls that didn't appear mauled at all. Trevor studied the curve of her shapely ass for a moment before abruptly slamming the door. Climbing into the cab, he pumped and throttled the engine a few shots to get the big block V8 firing on the alcohol fuel. The engine finally caught, and he started to roll into the dark tunnel.
Damn, I gotta get to the Gaudy house fast. Been so long without a slut that even the stiffs are starting to look good.
As the corpse-filled truck began to move, Christy rolled off Ryan, and both drew their blasters. Crawling over the dead, she looked out the tiny rearview window. The opening of the tunnel shrank in their wake. Dimly seen through the billowing dust clouds, the guards were searching the ground for their dropped SIGs. Ryan tied his eye patch on and pulled a few strands of his black hair loose that got caught in the knot.
Hope Jack is okay.
We would have heard them boasting if not.
Ryan retrieved his stire from underneath a headless torso.
Okay. We give this convoy a few minutes until we're near the middle of the tunnel. These things are long, sometimes a quarter mile in length. Water damage should rough both ends, but the middle will be smooth. Once the tires start humming, we go.
At least he's not going very fast. Won't hurt much jumping from this crawling can.
Agreed.
The redhead jiggled a handle on the door.
Ugh, locked. No surprise there. Probably don't want folks robbing the dead of blasters and such.
Ever hear of a baron who did?
Christy tried to stand, but the ceiling was too low. She debated sitting or kneeling, and settled for crouching on her heels. The blood in the guts didn't bother her as much as the warmth of the fresh corpses, suggesting a terrible mockery of life. Under her breath, she uttered a short prayer to Gaia. Soon, the bouncing of the rough road diminished, and the tires began to softly hum under the truck.
Ready?
Christy covered her ears with her palms.
Go ahead.
Placing a hand against the roof as a brace, Ryan aimed the 9mm Sig Sauer at the back door of the vehicle when the truck jounced through a deep pothole. The blaster coughed softly, blowing out the aft window in a loud crash of glass.
What the fuck was that?
The element of surprise gone, Ryan spun fast, estimating 3 feet off the floor and 2 feet from the left, then fired again twice more. The corpses and the truck's interior strobed from the flash of the shots. Without a pause, Ryan put another round through the passenger side of the vehicle. The truck started to zigzag wildly, began to slow, and abruptly stopped, throwing the companions and the corpses forward into a bloody pile. Forcibly extracting himself, Ryan kicked open the back door and jumped to the ground. Christy joined him in a heartbeat.
Can't chance hiding. We're in a tunnel with zero cover and nowhere to run.
The redhead pulled a knife into view.
Then we chill the bastards.
Racing around to the driver's side door, Ryan yanked it open and hauled out the dead man behind the wheel. Climbing into the cab, he fumbled in the darkness for the keys, but they weren't in the ignition anymore. When he got shot, the driver had to have yanked them loose. Ahead of them down the tunnel, the taillights of a flatbed truck flared brightly red as the brakes were applied. Christy slid into the passenger seat.
He's seen us!
Working on it!
Ryan scrounged madly about on the floor. Something metallic came under his fingers, and pain cut into his thumb. Damned pull top from a can. He cursed and brushed it aside. Then a jingling noise sounded as he touched something metallic, loose and on a ring.
Got him!
Fumbling a bit, he sat upright and tried a key in the ignition, but it didn't fit. Carefully sliding that down the ring, he cupped it in his palm to keep it out of the way and tried the next. That key was close, but not quite the correct size. It went in, but not all the way. Probably the key for the back door. The next key was huge and would never fit in the ignition switch. In the darkness ahead of them, a soft beeping sounded as the brake lights on the truck winked out and the vehicle began backing their way.
They're getting closer!
Christy patted her pockets for matches or a lighter to help Ryan see. She found a matchbox, but it proved to be empty. Closing his eye to concentrate, Ryan tried another key. Too small. The next he passed on, as the study key was round and the slot for the switch was long and thin. What the hell did this bastard have so many keys for? Blaster in hand, Christy opened her door and put one leg out, holding her blaster in both hands and resting the barrel on the window frame, assuming a firing stance.
30 yards!
Lots of keys remained on the ring, but they were out of time.
Last one, then we run for it.
Jabbing the worn key toward the slot, he was shocked when it smoothly slid into place. Stomping on the accelerator, Ryan turned the ignition, and the warm engine roared into life. Snapping on the headlights, he angled the wag away from the wall and started to creep forward. Christy closed her door, but kept the SNW-38 out the window in case of trouble. The truck ahead of them didn't slow, so Ryan beeped the horn. The honk produced was pitifully weak, most likely that way even before the centuries robbed it of power. So Ryan pounded on the horn a few more times. Feeble as it was, the other driver had to have heard the musical squeaks because he stopped the backward progress of the flatbed, and as they came dangerously close, the other truck began to roll forward.
He thinks we stalled.
Ryan eased the tension in his arms and hands.
These old engines probably do it constantly.
Well, we were lucky with this truck.
He shifted uncomfortably in his seat. The bullet hole had forced out a spring that was digging into his ribs and annoying the hell out of him.
Can't chance that again with the flatbed. Must have three guys or more riding shotgun, and if they see us, we're in for a fight.
The tunnel gently curved to the left. Ryan had always wondered why long tunnels did that, until Mildred explained it to him. The angle was a brake slope, designed to ease the rush of water charging along the tunnel, should there be a mid-span break.
Two of them, two of us. We can take them.
Can't chance it. Getting that medkit is our top priority. If we get caught, Dean could be dead before we could escape.
He'll be fine. He's tougher than a nail.
Dean's a survivor.
That was the highest compliment Ryan could give a man.
Look, we have maybe 10 or 15 minutes before we reach the end of this tunnel. We have to come up with a plan.
Yeah, I know.
Ryan shifted gears as the curve gently straightened.
I'll have something by then. Maybe we could... fire blast!
Up ahead, faint orange daylight streamed into the tunnel, and tiny figures were walking around on the ground near what resembled a machine gun nest and a concrete barricade. Standing guard on the roof of the federal building, Doc checked his wind-up pocket chron. The timepiece said noon, but the sky above belied the fact, with streaming yellow clouds, streaked with lambent red and blotchy with purple. Even the lizards in the street seemed to know a bad storm was approaching, as they dug holes in the sand and collapsed the openings upon themselves. Careful not to pinch his fingers, J.B. lowered the sheet of plexiglass into the skylight frame. The janitor's closet had been a windfall of material, including replacement glass for the windows and skylight. Unfortunately, the silicon putty had long ago turned into a dried brick, but he had an answer for that problem.
How's it look?
The armorer extracted a candle from the bag at his feet. Crushing a pellet of pyrotab so it burst into flame, he lit the wick before the chemical compound burned itself out. Standing nearby, Doc removed his gaze from the ville around them and studied the repair job.
Good.
The Heckler & Koch G-12 rested in the crook of his arm. Rifles weren't his forte, but as a rooftop sentry he needed something a lot quieter and with greater range than his hogleg 44 Lamar. Dean's caseless rifle fit the bill perfectly, even though this was the last reload. 100 rounds, and the blaster was dead.
Very good, in fact. That soap you smeared on the inside of the sheet makes it seem sandblasted, just like the others.
Tilting the candle, J.B. carefully dribbled the melting wax along the edge of the glass, using a stick to push it into place. He just nodded, concentrating on his work. This window needed to resemble the others in the skylight, so that nothing and nobody could tell this was where Dean had fallen through.
It'll last for months if the weather holds.
More than sufficient. The flask is still half full. Some more coffee?
Hell yes.
It had been a long night moving their supplies over to this building, and then erasing every trace of the work, using brooms to sweep away their tracks in the sand. Just then came the single crack of a blaster. J.B. dropped the candle and rotated on his heels, his Uzi out and ready.
Muties?
Doc shouldered the HK.
Skylight.
Come again?
Disguising our location is a logical precaution, agreed? However, I decided to augment the strategy by offering any possible hunters an alternate locale for investigation.
Ah, you shut out another skylight. Where?
Doc pointed to the place where he had caused the deliberate damage.
There, a few blocks over. A most prudent expenditure of ammunition, I can assure you.
J.B. smiled.
I agree. But you honestly think the muties might be smart enough to recall that Dean fell through a skylight and will check out the other one instead?
Ryan once told me of some sage advice the trader taught him. When you underestimate the enemy, what you really do is overestimate yourself.
That sure sounds like the trader to me.
J.B.'s laughter ceased as he stared hard at the streets below. A dust cloud was coming their way.
Incoming.
The two men moved to the corner of the roof and studied the approaching vehicle.
The Hummer, I see. And pray tell, who is that riding with our young Mr. Lauren?
Mac's blaster pressed hard into Jack's side.
Stop here.
The boy didn't reply, but brought the Hummer to a stop a few stores down the street from the pawn shop. A voice suddenly called out from the roof.
Hello!
Trying to hide the blaster, Mac craned his neck, glancing around. Nobody was visible. The voice spoke again.
Hello down there!
A man wearing glasses and a hat appeared over the edge of a roof, waving and greeting.
Jack, I see you have company.
The head sec man put on a friendly smile.
Answer him.
Jack's hands stayed motionless on the steering wheel.
So can kill friends?
Fuck you, man.
Viciously, Mac dug the barrel of his gun deeper into the teenager's ribs. He expected a whimper of pain, but got only a soft grunt.
Just do as I tell you, Snowball, and both you and your buddy will live to see another day. You'll both become proud citizens of Alphaville.
We live?
Of course. You're still breathing, ain't you?
Jack glared at the man out of the corner of an eye, as J.B. called out to them again.
Hey! Something wrong?
Wave and tell him to come on down.
Mac twisted the barrel of the gun. Jack grunted again, a reddish stain on his vest slowly spreading out from the spot. Beaming happily, Mac clicked back the hammer.
Do it or die. I have nothing to lose.
Jack called out to the armorer, snapping off a friendly salute.
No problems. Come down, Bruce. Want to meet old buddy from Bayou.
The Bayou, eh?
J.B. smiled, doffing his hat and waving it twice.
Great! Is that your cousin Charlie?
Brian.
The man from the roof cupped an ear.
Hey, what was that?
Brian. Name is Brian.
The conversation was taking an odd turn, and Mac was starting to get suspicious. He debated chilling the albino and driving off immediately when a bizarre noise sounded, sort of like a zipper unfastening, only much faster and louder. Instantly, the windshield of the Hummer shattered into a million pieces, and white-hot pain stabbed the sec man as a flurry of 4.7-millimeter rounds ripped into his chest. Jack dove from the Hummer just as the Coldheart fired his blaster, blowing a hole in the canvas door. Another flurry hit, and Mac jerked about madly, his chest spouting crimson like a punctured water balloon. The dying man worked his mouth a few times, trying to speak, blood flowing freely over his lips, and he slumped over and hit his head on the dashboard. Sporting the HKG-12, Doc stepped from the doorway of the federal building.
How are you doing, Jack?
Name's Alvin.
Jack smiled, dusting himself off. Doc relaxed and waved at the roof. J.B. returned the gesture and disappeared from view. By the time he reached the street, Jack and Doc were already hauling the corpse into the back of the Hummer.
Good idea hiding a body. The smell of blood will attract animals for miles.
As the hijacker slumped limply into the cargo area, Doc prodded the corpse with his ebony cane.
And pray tell, who was our uninvited visitor?
Coldheart sec man captured me.
Jack held his side and winced.
Used muty wolves bring in people to city.
Looking at the dead man more closely, J.B. recalled that this was one of the men who had fired the blanks at the wolves, chasing that unfortunate family into the ruins. Gathering the dropped blaster from where it fell, Doc inspected the dead sec man's blaster.
Excellent piece. Fine condition.
He cracked the cylinder and checked the ammo. The bullets were reloads, but very well done.
Any more in his pockets?
Expertly, Jack rifled the dead man's clothing.
Just spoon, can opener, cig lighter.
I'll take the lighter.
Jack tossed it over.
4 rounds, is it, then?
Doc walked to the front of the Hummer and slid the blaster into the map compartment.
Never hurts to have a spare.
JB tucked the butane lighter into his munitions bag.
How did he get the drop on you?
Muties came at night. Had to run. Caught me leaving Forest.
Jack made a face. He had been caught unawares like a stoop, and he felt embarrassed.
Shoved blast in my face. No choice but obey.
JB could read the teenager's expression.
I would have done the same myself. Don't let it get you down. Let's just figure out where we should dispose of the body.
River. Water carried to ocean.
Exemplary, my young friend. Let us be off.
Jack agreed, then he winced as sweat touched the cut in his side.
Hey, are you hurt?
Jack dismissed his concern, showing the minor wound.
Just scratch, don't worry. How Dean?
JB cast his eyes downward.
No change.
Oh.
By the way, where are Ryan and Christy? Any news on the whereabouts of the medical kit?
Quickly, Jack told them what happened.
So they tracked him inside the Ville. Damn, I don't like the fact that we have no way of contacting them, or even keeping track of their progress.
Perhaps there is a way.
Doc studied the cloudy sky. It was difficult to gauge the hour with the heavy blanket of storm clouds blocking the sun. His pocket cron was working fine, but since they didn't know where they were, it could be hours, fast or slow, in regard to the local time. They didn't even know if they were still in America.
4, maybe 5 hours of light remain. Not nearly enough for my plan. Gentlemen, I suggest Jack stay with Dr. Wyeth and bring her up to date, while John Barrymore and I drop off our guest, and then reconnoiter a few stores to see if we can find some barbed wire for the internal defenses.
Something moved in the cloudy sky, and the companions drew their weapons, dropping into combat crouches. The lone Stingwing circled overhead, then moved off.
Here.
Doc passed the teenager the G-12.
The Uzi and my Lamar should be sufficient protection for this brief sojourn, but if there is trouble here, you will need the extra firepower.
Accepting the rifle, Jack waited judiciously.
Feels light. 90 rounds?
80. I was a bit overzealous eliminating your unwanted passenger.
Jack rested the stock on his hip.
Phew, shot him, not me. No complaints.
Doc wiped off the blood on the front seat before climbing into the wag.
Tomorrow morning we shall go back to the redoubt and load up on all the fuel we can find. Then we go hunting.
For the muties?
Better.
The old man explained his plan as JB started the engine and drove off. Wiping the dirt off his hand, Gunther breathed in the rich fragrance of the greenhouse and stopped for a moment to admire the beautiful green plants surrounding him in rows upon rows. The shafts of corn were thickly golden, with rich chaff almost bursting to get out. The new tomatoes were small, but growing steadily larger, and the carpeting of soybeans underneath the tall plants was so thick the leaves had a bluish hue. Leonard poked his head through the doorway.
Excuse me, Baron. Important news.
Report.
The Baron gently turned a leaf to inspect the underside for any signs of infestation.
Will you look here? That old book we found was correct. Mixing cigarette tobacco and soapy water completely killed those aphids. How clever the ancient gardeners were.
The teenager stepped closer.
Sir, we have been invaded.
Retrieving shears from a wicker basket of implements, the Baron snipped off a ripe tomato and placed it reverently in a cushion of clean cloth. It would be a special treat for his dinner tonight.
I do not hear blaster fire in the streets.
He noticed a mealworm on the stalk. Savagely he crushed the insect, then wiped his fingers in the rich dark loam beneath the plants. Waste not, want not.
Mac, Larry, and Trevor found some dead jolt dealers in the ruins. The muties had got to them.
The Baron tilted his head in thought. The air of the greenhouse was rich, almost pungent, with the smell of life itself.
Good. Some of our most recent arrivals had warned us about people like that. Now the problem has been corrected. Did we get much in the way of tools and blasters?
No tools, but cases of auto fires and 100 weight of ammo.
Then what is the problem? This is excellent news.
But when the convoy arrived, the last truck, the one carrying the corpses, rammed through the barricade, killing 2 of our sec men and destroying the big machine gun.
Power flowed into Gunther's voice as the last gossamer traces of tranquility faded from his demeanor.
The driver did this?
No, sir. Trevor was supposed to be driving. We found him 500 yards down the tunnel, shot through the back.
And when we did a head count of the guards, Mac turned up missing.
Mac, the head sec man, and one of the wolf pack. This was not good. He'd have to promote Xanders now.
You are my right hand, Leonard. There are three possibilities, so we shall start with the most obvious. The fight occurred inside the tunnel, the worst possible location for an attack, so it wasn't a sec man turned traitor. They would have waited until the trucks were in the ruins, far from our retaliation. So what does that indicate?
That one of the corpses wasn't as dead as they thought.
We think alike, son. Yes, the guards must have been lax checking the bodies again, and one came awake and killed the driver. But it would take a truly exceptional man to accomplish such a task. Our drivers are chosen for their physical strength, brawn over brain.
So where should we start looking for the corpse? Returning through the tunnel would be impossible without a wag. So he must have taken refuge within our vill.
Gathering the basket of produce, Gunther stood towering over his adopted son. The boy's hair was red, almost as red as his own, but it was flat and lifeless. The similarity to himself, only cosmetic.
Alert all of our sec men. Find the intruder before nightfall.
The words "or else" weren't spoken, nor was it necessary. Leonard understood. Invaders were spies, assassins, or thieves. There were no other possibilities, and all were automatically sentenced to the machine.
Check the market square. That is where he or she will most likely try to mingle in with the citizens.
Then that is where we shall capture him.
Leonard snapped his heels.
Exactly. And capture him alive. If this man is an advanced scout, we'll need to know the plans of the enemy.
Then he goes to the machine.
Eventually. Did he steal the blasters of the sec men?
No, Father. Which means he has a blaster of his own.
And a good one. Keep a close watch on the Gaudy House. Wild men with good blasters may seek the comfort of a slut, where a single bullet buys them hours of pleasure. In fact, arrest all strangers who visit the house tonight. Unless I miss my guess, we'll find our invader among the immigrants.
In her office and bedroom behind the bar of the Gaudy House, Madame Patrika took the canvas bag from the hunchback's eager hands. She was suspicious of what could possibly be inside. The gimp had been gone for only a day. If there were a cache of blasters within a day's walk, surely the Baron and his army of sekmen would have found it by now. They did regular sweeps through the ruins, and every inch of the vill was checked, rechecked, catalogued, and indexed. That Leonard had a mind like a steel trap, and remembered everything he ever saw or heard, damn him. No cheating on your taxes with the Baron's adopted son doing the tally. Frigging bastard could even add and subtract.
Okay, let's see what you got for me.
Patrika loosened the ties. Right off, the bag itself was of some value. There wasn't a hole in the fabric, and the buckle still worked. She shook it and heard a delicious metallic rattle of steel on steel. Perhaps it was a bag full of blasters.
You like?
Harold beamed, bobbing his head as if in church.
Good stuff. Best. I take Laura now.
Not yet, boy. But not until I see in what condition the blasters are, and how much ammo there is. We had a deal, remember?
Harold smiled so wide he drooled.
Remember? Good stuff. You like.
It took every ounce of control Patrika possessed, not to gasp in wonder, when she opened the canvas bag and found it full of pre-dark medical supplies in perfect condition. It was a Baron's ransom of technology, more than enough to buy half of Alphaville. But she had to act like the stuff wasn't worth its true value.
Bah! Useless!
She forced herself to curse, rummaging a hand through the surgical instruments. The flawless steel felt as smooth as silk.
Where are the blasters? I don't see any blasters in here, just some old junk!
Harold felt confused.
Better. Fix his people is better.
Patrika crossed her plump arms across her flabby breasts.
I said blasters, didn't I, boy? Is this a blaster?
Better.
The madam dropped the pack and kicked it into the corner.
Useless. I can't do anything with this. Now go get me some blasters.
Patrika reached out and shook the man.
You savvy blasters? Revolvers, pistols, boomsticks! Get me blasters or I put Laura to work tonight!
Harold shook off the hand and stood to his full height.
No! No! She no work here!
He grabbed the madam and lifted her off the floor.
her shoes wildly kicking to find a purchase.
She no work here! Wife!
The fat woman gasped in terror.
Yes, of course. Laura, no work here. I was only teasing. Joke! A joke! No work here. Never work here, okay? Okay?
Okay.
Harold's face was a mask of feral madness. As effortlessly as if he were holding a child, and not a 400-pound woman, he returned her to the floor. Wheezing for air, Patrika retreated behind her desk and started to open a drawer with a machete hidden under a towel, then thought better of the action, and slowly slid the drawer closed. The desire to kill had been plain on his face, and the woman wondered if her little game was worth the chance of reward. One wrong move, and he would smash her apart. In that instant, her decision was made. Whatever the gimp brought back as payment next time, she would accept as enough, and then kill him. He was a golden goose, but one with the fangs of a tiger.
I go get blasters. Magnum 16s, Remingtons, one bag full blasters.
Harold started for the door, then stopped and glared at Patrika, his hatred clearly visible. He rubbed a forearm across his wet jaw.
You obey deal, or you no friend.
Shaking more with rage than fear, Patrika watched the door close, the handle ripping out of the wood as the hunchback stomped away in barely controlled fury. A wave of outrage swept over the madam, and her gaze shifted to the spot where he had dared to lay a hand on her, as if she were one of the sluts working upstairs, just another common whore. That spot was where the gimp would die, his guts spilling out onto the floor, screaming and weeping for his life, as Patrika hacked away at his limbs, until the misshapen body was reduced to flesh and bones. Striding to the wall, she opened a battered cabinet and withdrew a knotted leather whip, a specialty item reserved for the Baron himself when he visited on tax day. Her back twitched in memory of those awful hours. Expertly coiling the banded leather, Patrika cracked the whip and cut a chunk of wood the size of a plum out of her desk. Leaving the office, the madam closed and locked the door carefully, then lifted a fat leg and started to climb the stairs for the next level, the long length of the bullwhip trailing behind, the knotted tip bouncing off every step as she waddled higher and higher.
Party time, retard.
Soaring from their honeycombed nest, the winged muties swirled in the cloudy sky to hide the location of the home, as the first one had taught them so long ago. The moon was full, but the clouds were heavy, and the light was perfect for a hunt tonight. Then a scout cried out and swooped to the ground, sailing over the still body of a dead male. The passage of his wings ruffled the corpse, scaring away the lizards feeding on the lifeless form. Furious, the whole flock took up the cry of his demise, the ruins reverberating from the high-pitched squeals of rage. Swarms of creatures swooped down to snatch scurrying lizards and grind them alive in powerful jaws. The tiny squeals of pain were music for the tasty meal. Staying above the fighters, lost amid the breeders and the young, the first one was silent in her thoughts as she winged over the ruins, studying a broken skylight. A hunter was dead, and there was a new hole. A connection was made in her mind, and she called for fighters to investigate. Abandoning the lizards, dozens of the muties poured into the insurance building, smashing the skylight apart in their mad rush to gain entrance. The creatures spread across every floor like locusts, and down the staircase to the lower levels. The largest of the beasts went straight to the bottom, and sailed around the basement, searching for any sign of the prey. But the air was stale, with no blood smell or sweat to spark the killing urge. This was another empty place, like the rest of the hunting ground. No food here. Soaring above the ruins, the great first one studied the sand and stone of her domain. The soil between the stone hives was still radiating away the heat of the day, and prey could easily mask its presence on the ground. But that would only last for a short while, and then the screaming flesh would be easily visible, with nowhere to hide. Keeping in command to the rest of her flock, the leader winged off between the towers of stone, black eyes scanning the night for the telltale glow of living flesh.
She didn't understand how the two legs could kill a fighter or evade the flock, but so much the better. Food always tasted better after a hunt. Screaming a challenge, the first one banked to the left, folding both wings to dive for the ground, soaring beyond the stinking waters where hundreds of prey walked. Enough meat to feed the folk and the young hatchlings for a week. Unfortunately, the blinding columns of sunlight were moving through the sky, and it hurt the old mother to even glance in that direction. But the slaughter from the previous dark time had taught the fighters a new trick. Perhaps this night, the hated two legs would fall before the flock, and the feasting could truly begin. Sitting in a chair on the second floor, Mildred sipped a cup of stale coffee, the Heckler & Koch caseless rifle balanced across her lap, and a primed Law at her feet, ready for instant use. Below was an irregular plan of mismatched drapes and curtains. That was JB's idea. They had found enough barbed wire at a local hardware store to crisscross the central area of the building twice, so they put one layer at the topmost level, directly under the skylight, to help fend off falling glass, and the other on the ground level. The lower spiderweb of steel they carefully blanketed with the drapes to block any possible light from below, and hopefully to hide from the muties the fact that there was a basement. Mildred didn't care how bizarre their biochemistry or physiology was. They had heads the size of a toaster, and thus couldn't be very smart, no matter how many folds their brains might have. Small was stupid, end of discussion. Suddenly, the skylight brightened, and the woman realized the storm clouds had to have parted, finally allowing moonlight to seep through. The physician debated awakening J.B. so he could shoot their position with his sextant, but she declined. It didn't matter where this Zero City was. Location wouldn't help their predicament. Bathed in the reflected moonlight, the government building was eerie in the silence, without even the drip of water or creaking wooden floorboards to disturb the thick silence. Time passed slowly and steadily, the physician relaxing in the comfortable office chair, conserving her energy and thinking about her odd life and where it had taken her, daydreaming about what might have been, wishing and hoping. With a start, Mildred jerked awake, the blaster tight in her hands. Damn, she'd fallen asleep in spite of the military coffee. The woman glanced at her wrist chron and saw that several hours had passed. Listening intently, Mildred tried to hear what had awakened her from such a deep sleep. There was no commotion from below, which was a good sign. JB was asleep next to Dean, just in case the boy had any more trouble breathing. A tiny noise came, sounding like a mouse running across the floor, fast and fleeting. Only it wasn't coming from below or behind. In horror, Mildred glanced up and saw a dark shape outlined in the frosty glass of the skylight, the maze of barbed wire between them blurring any possible details. Reaching out, she tugged on a piece of string tied to the railing, the other end securely wrapped around Jack's forefinger. Soon there came an answering tug in a 2-3-2 pattern, meaning the teenager was awake. She tugged 1-2-1, and he replied in kind, showing he understood the situation. The men would be awake in seconds to guard Dean, but the physician was the first line of defense should the creatures breach the glass. Releasing the string, Mildred stood slowly and raised the blaster toward the distant skylight, flicking off the safety. The blood was pounding in her veins, and Mildred seemed to have preternatural senses. She knew it was only a fear-induced adrenaline rush, but it still seemed as if she could almost see the winged muties on the rooftop, prowling around, searching for an opening, a hole, any way to reach the human food inside. Controlling her breathing, Mildred aimed the blaster, slid the fire control to full auto, and waited for the sound of shattering glass. Long pink tongues lolling from the desert heat, a pack of wolves padded through the stone forest of man. The flat-faced mountains rose into the distant sky, and when the soft sand gave way to hard slabs of black rock, their claws clicked on the odd material. The evening wind was blowing steadily from the east, the smell of old blood fueling their fury and forcing them onward. A pack of man had somehow slain all the males of their pack, and the stink of the skinned flesh wafting through the night ignited a savagery in the wolves that bordered on madness. The two legs in the iron forest had taught them to herd man to them in exchange for food. The wolves liked the game, and feared the two legs with their boomsticks. But this was a matter of blood. The killers had to be killed. It was the way of their world, the law of the new jungle. And over the years, the wolves had learned to attack man from behind, or strike from the shadows, and the deadly boomsticks would only make noise, but nothing more. And without the stick, man was easy food. Furry ears pricked upward as a faint trace of smoke in the air made the wolf snarl in response to the possibility of fire. Then the lead female growled, and the rest kept moving, warily stalking around a corner. Smoke was the scent of man. The prey was near. Suddenly, a breeze washed over the animals, carrying the reek of rotting meat, and they froze motionless, recognizing a familiar danger. Nostrils flared, eyes darting, they sought the source of the stench, when there was a blur of movement, and a young bitch fell over with her head gone, warm blood pumping from the gaping neck wound. Snarling wildly, the wolves formed a hasty circle, baring their fangs as they faced in every direction. The wind washed over them again with an odd snapping sound, and another tumbled over dead. The pack went wild, darting around in a circle, trying to find the unseen attackers. However, nothing was visible, and the numbing stench completely blocked their ability to sniff out even a general direction. Then a struggling wolf was lifted bodily into the dark, warm blood sprinkling down like gentle rain. Self-preservation overwhelmed loyalty, and the pack ran for the safety of the distant dunes. But as they raced down the sandy street, a third was beheaded, a fourth disappeared, a fifth howled in unimaginable agony as most of its back was violently removed. Whimpering in terror, a few of the wolves rolled on their backs to expose their bellies in total surrender. Others desperately crawled underneath broken stonework, while the rest fled in blind panic, moving like gray ghosts in the darkness. Nothing worked. Soon, only scraps of warm fur and slowly spreading pools of blood marred the sandy stretch of roadway as deathly silence returned to the ancient ruins. The bodies of the wolves were nowhere to be seen.